the many years I've been doing the Michael Slate Show, I find myself saying that these are really intense times, where this has been a packed week. But right now, as I'm preparing today's show, I keep thinking, whoa, we all need to do something. The deaths from COVID-19 reached 350,000 worldwide, as the pandemic threatens to wreak still more horrors, especially right now in Brazil and the rest of Latin America. And every public health official says that the number of deaths, each of them the loss of a precious human life, are certainly undercounted. Okay. The death toll in the U.S. just passed 100,000 dead. And a recent study in the Guardian newspaper found that black people are dying at a rate of 3 or 5, or as many as 7 times the death rate in the population as a whole. Trump has been using the pandemic to advance the consolidation of fascism, encouraging and supporting fascist reopened stormtroopers and plotting to rig the November elections. And amidst all this, the police brutality and murder carried out by this system has seen no letup. Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and now George Floyd, murdered by police in Minneapolis, gasping, "I can't breathe," while a pig kneeled on his neck for 7 minutes. So at the back end of the show, we're going to hear an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on the question everyone should be asking and agonizing over. How long? How many more times do the tears have to flow? This is a speech from BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, given in 2012. He talks about the murders of Manuel Diaz, Joel Acevedo, Oscar Grant, and Romare Graham, names that we hold in our hearts, along with too many others. And he talks about what it's going to take to stop it. And now, opening the show up, I'm welcoming back to the show Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. I should mention on the occasion of Memorial Day that when he was a GI during the Vietnam War and the Army gave him orders to go to Vietnam, he said, hell no, refused to go and did time in prison rather than do the service that the system wanted him to do. We talked a few days ago about the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, the death of prisoners and immigrant detainees in the coronavirus pandemic, and the slow genocide of black and brown people that is now speeding up. So let's hear from Carl Dix. The recent lynching of Ahmaud Arbery has seared the soul of black people and many others throughout the society, calling to mind slave catchers and lynch mobs of old. The question is sharply posed, when will this end? Bob Avakian's written that there is the potential for something of unprecedented beauty to arise out of unspeakable ugliness, black people playing a crucial role in putting an end at long last to this system which has for so long not just exploited but dehumanized, terrorized, and tormented them in thousands of ways. Putting an end to this in the only way that it can be done, by fighting to emancipate humanity, to put an end to the long night in which human society has been divided into masters and slaves, and the masses of humanity have been lashed, beaten, raped, slaughtered, shackled, and shrouded in ignorance and misery. You know, and I wanted to read that in conjunction with the intro to this, because when I first saw the news of the lynching of Ahmaud Arbery, it was one of those things that just sort of jumped at you, and it just sort of took your breath away. You know, you have this anger that's building up in you, and you're looking for a way. One, you want to dig in deeper to understand more fully exactly what had happened, and to basically to dig into it and to try and figure out, okay, how are we going to stop this? How are we going to stop this insane, murderous, I'm at a loss for a word, you know, it's just this horrible, these horrible assaults on people who aren't white, on people who aren't straight, on people who are from other countries. And, you know, and in particular, in relation to black people in this country, there is just a horrible history of the dehumanization and the slaughter of black people day in and day out. And as I was thinking about all this, I decided I want to write to Carl Dix, and I want to get hold of him and have him come on the show, because Carl has been writing about this. He's been also following a lot of this general thing that we're talking about. He's put up a challenge to people, a challenge to all people in society. And I think it's important that we dig into this. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Well, let's talk about what happened to Ahmaud Arbery. Let's talk about this lynching, which is exactly what it was. And let's talk about what it means and what it says about the lives of black people in the U.S.
Yeah, we'll see. Look, the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, the lynching of Ahmaud Arbery, hit me like a punch to the gut. Look, because you were absolutely right when you said it brought to mind the slave chasers and the lynchings of old, because it was really a couple of white guys got some guns and went hunting for this black guy who ran through their neighborhoods. They came up with some justification for hunting him down, chasing him, confronting him, and ultimately murdering him. But that is what this was. And it does pose, how long is this going to continue to go down? How long are black people going to be subjected to this kind of open, naked, white supremacist violence? And we could add to that, how long are any of the other horrors that this system brings down on people? How long are they going to continue to go down, whether that's immigrants in cages on the border, you know, in detention camps, whether that's the attacks on women, their right to choose to have an abortion and their very humanity, whether that's the devastation of the climate, of the planet that we live on. How long is all of this going to go down? And look, there is an answer to it. It's going to continue to go on unless and until we make revolution and get rid of the system that spawns it. And that's where this has to take us, because when you look at it, that historical continuity of that kind of violence directed at black people screams out to you that maybe the forms of the savage oppression that black people face in this country have changed over the centuries and decades, but the reality of that continuing oppression has not changed. It is still there, and it's not there by accident. It's not there because of some defect in the nature of white people. It is there because the subjugation of black people has been woven into the fabric and framework of this system that we live under from the time the first Africans were dragged to these shores in slave chains. The forms have changed because those Africans who were dragged to these shores ended up being a slave labor force whose unpaid labor forced out of them at the end of a whip ended up being part of the very foundation for the wealth and power of America, together with the theft of the land from the native inhabitants and almost wiping them completely out. That's where this wealth and power came from. The Civil War formally ended slavery, but it only changed the forms that the subjugation of black people took. It became slavery by another name, sharecropping on the plantation, cheated, ripped off by the plantation owners, subjected to convict leasing, where black people would be arrested if they had no white person to vouch for them, sentenced to jail, and then lynched off to be virtually slaves. This was slavery by another name. And all of this was enforced by the lynch mob terror of the white mobs that would go out hunting black people, in some cases hunting specific black people for some real or imagined crime, but in other cases, hunting the first black man they could find to string up as a message to everybody else to stay in their place. And again, that changed after World War II with the great upsurge of migration of black people out of the South, and black people went from being sharecroppers to the bottom tier of the industrial workforce. And then it became a thing of not the lynch mobs, but the police forces that carried this out. So this is the development of it, the changing in the form, but the continuing of the oppression. And we just got to cite the fact that police kill 1,000 people a year, disproportionately black and brown. And when you go through it and look at the circumstances, It was like, I thought that lighter was a gun. I thought that wallet was a gun. I thought that cell phone was a gun. I thought those keys were a gun. Sometimes there was nothing and stole another life of a black or brown person. This has been the history of America. And throughout the history, this is going down. And when you see that, and see that all of the things that have been done to try to change it, whether that was getting black politicians into office, the anniversary of the MOVE massacre has just passed, and I remembered going down to Philly in the wake of the bombing of the MOVE house in 1985 and struggling with people that this needed to be called out and being told by people who hated the oppression of black people that they couldn't call it out because a black mayor presided over it. And that is our surest route to ending this oppression. So we have to cut this one some slack because a black mayor was responsible for it. Up to Obama getting elected and people saying they had made their revolution and that now black people really had power in the society, and watching Obama preside over police continuing to murder people and getting away with it scot-free, as well as becoming the deporter-in-chief of Latino immigrants and the drone bomb king, dropping drone missiles into villages in the Middle East and South Asia. So the ways that have been put out there to deal with it have led to nothing. And people got to break with the view that our solution lies within the framework of the system. They got to see that we got to get out from under that system. They got to get out of a view that there's nothing we can do, that we're powerless. And whether it's religion that's the stranglehold that has you in there looking for a better world in the by and by or whatever, people got to break with it and get out of it and really confront the reality for what it is, but also dig into the solution to that reality. And the solution is an actual revolution.
A couple things I wanted to follow up on before we get into anything further on. But, you know, this whole point about mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide. And I think that's something that a lot of people just either they brush away or they don't even think about it. Basically, in recent days, this has become very, very intensely real and dangerous. And yet, you know, and you've even seen that there was a recent piece on RevCom.us that states that America's prisons are on the brink of becoming death camps. And, you know, if you were to actually you talk about all these people that you were talking to, or you let know what's going on there and you're interacting with them and the responses you get. And I found that even among the best of my friends, I found it very difficult for them to sort of immediately, and then oftentimes it's through a lot of struggle, to actually recognize that we are talking about being on the brink of death camps. And this is something that is not to be dismissed, is not to be, you know, like, oh, get out of those old times. This is not something that just existed with Hitler or any of these other people. And then you think about it, these monsters that have been ruling all over the world, and who's ruling right here, right now? And it doesn't matter who, you know, in a certain sense, yes, you know, you can talk about this, we can talk about the stuff that Obama did, that other people did, but we also have one of the biggest all-time monsters in U.S. history is actually sitting there. And that is a criminal who actually probably finds the idea of death camps not being too unlikable.
Yeah, this is actually an important point and helps to round out the picture, because that phrase mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide is something that we began to push out there almost a decade ago, looking at mass incarceration, police terror, and it being the spearhead of a savage attack on black and brown people in this country. And in doing that, a lot of people were like, you're hyping this. It isn't that bad. It's bad. You need to do something about it, but it isn't that bad. And those people didn't understand what genocide actually is, because most people think of genocide as being the last phase of it, when the mass killings happen, whether that's people being lined up against the wall and shot and buried in mass graves or taken to the death camps and put in the gas ovens and stuff like that. That is the end result of a genocide. But genocide is a process, and it really is a matter of a people in whole or in part being put in circumstances where they cannot survive and thrive as people. That has been going on with black people in particular, also increasingly with Latinos and other peoples of color here in this country, that large sections of them, when you look at how many people are in prison, over 2 million, and over 60-65% of them black or brown, that's people who are not in position to survive and thrive. And then when you look at what that means, because it's not just the 1-1.5 million people who are in prison, but it's all those who are tied to them and who literally go to prison with them, even though they're not behind bars. Their lives get tethered to that. This is what we're up against, and this is a section of people, a sizable section of people, who can't survive and thrive as people. That was already the case. Then you have this global pandemic, the coronavirus, coming down. And the case is, and this is something that people really need to look at and confront, when you talk about what are some of the major coronavirus hotspots in the country, they either revolve around nursing homes, meatpacking plants, or prisons. And if you take it as far as large population centers, a study on this found that 8 of the top 10 hotspots were indeed prisons on both the federal and state level. In some cases, they started doing tests of prisoners in a federal correction facility in Marion. I believe that's in Ohio. 80% of the prisoners were infected with the coronavirus. Many other prisons, the same kind of thing is going on, but they're just not testing people. So you don't know exactly how many and exactly what percentage, but it's hundreds of people on Rikers Island, the prison here in New York, who have been infected with the coronavirus. The same kind of problem is happening in the Cook County Jail in Illinois, the prison in Statesville, Illinois. Prisoners are sneaking in cell phones, and they always say, well, we got to stop the prisoners from getting these cell phones because they're doing illegal things. But what the prisoners are doing with these cell phones right now is using them to get the word out about how people are dying in there, and nobody's doing anything about it. Just think about it. You're in prison, and how are you told to deal with the coronavirus? Wash your hands frequently with soap and water. Maintain 6 feet of social distancing away from people who may be infected. Have access to adequate health care. None of those things are possible in prison. Somebody in there gets infected, that's like all of the people in that prison are now in a petri dish for the coronavirus. There has been talk, like the governor in New York does these daily briefings, and he's talked about what they're doing about the virus in prison. But when you actually look to see what gets done, it's just about nothing. Because they have said, well, we're going to release people who can be released so that the prisons aren't overcrowded and people aren't subjected to it. But what that has come down to in New York, this process started 6 weeks ago. Right now, they're at less than 1% of the prisoners have been released, even though they have said that prisoners over a certain age, people who are within a year of the end of their sentence, and people who are in prison for certain minor offenses were supposed to be released, but none of this is happening. And then the other thing about prisons that's important to look at, Rikers Island is a prison with thousands of people in it. Hundreds of them have contracted the coronavirus. And 85% of the people in that prison are only in there because they can't afford the bail. They ain't been convicted of nothing. They have no sentence to start serving because they ain't been convicted of nothing. But now, because of the pandemic, they are facing a potential death sentence. This is what we're looking at, and it is prisons potentially becoming death camps. And people have to say, is this something to be allowed to happen?
Yeah, absolutely, man. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. You know, and just even to just add something, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, what you were saying, and then I was realizing too, when you look at what's happening in this country, when you look at the comparison between what's happening here and what's happening in regimes across the world, the U.S. actually has 4% of the world's population, and yet it has 22% of the world's prisoners. And that's just the people that have been actually counted. And I think this point that you're making of this stuff, of these millions of people, prisoners and detainees trapped in a petri dish for the coronavirus, this whole point about basically the U.S. prisons on the brink of becoming, I read something that said it's on the brink of becoming death camps. And you have to wonder, like, it's not that big of a leap to go from being on the brink of to actually being, you know, one of these death camps. And I think the stuff that I've read over the last couple of weeks has just been just heartbreaking, makes you angry as hell, makes you try to figure out, okay, what the hell, how long is this going to go on? This is, and you watch that pig get up every day and walk out and prance around and all of his idiotic nonsense, and recognizing that while he's doing all that, that he's actually got this heinous, this criminal, this inhuman thing going on that he's presiding over. Trump is presiding over all of this in service to this whole system internationally, but especially here. You know, that this is actually a part of the backbone of how this system sees dealing with and treating Black people, other oppressed nationalities. This is incredibly important for people to understand. This is sort of not that far removed, if it's removed at all, from the kinds of stuff that Hitler was doing.
Yeah, and see, that's an analogy that has to be brought to bear, because when you look at the way in which this Trump-Pence regime is presiding over this and responding to this global pandemic of coronavirus, what is increasingly being brought to the fore is that there are sections of people whose deaths are acceptable in the context of the functioning of society. You know, when they talk about, well, it's going to mean some deaths, but we got to open up. We got to reopen the society. We can't be locked down. We can't let our economy be frozen. And they are literally saying that there are people who are expendable. This talk about, well, I see them as warriors. It actually isn't a warriors thing. There are expendable people who are being thrown into the face of potential death to keep things functioning. And it's a fascistic orientation and ethos. And then look at who it comes down to. People in prison. Well, they're prisoners. And in fact, some of Trump's people were saying, when the people started raising the thing about the prisoners, they were saying things like there's no right to social distancing in prison. In other words, you did the crime, so in addition to doing the time, you may give your life for that. The meatpacking plants have been forced to open. Workers are told they have to come back to work or lose their jobs. Who is it that works in those plants? A large number of the workers there are immigrants, and the workforce is majority Black or brown. The virus is also spreading on several reservations, and states have taken steps to not allow the reservation to do what it could to try to deal with it. So we do have a fascist regime responding to a pandemic in ways that stamp broad sections of people as of less value and possible their lives taken away through the spread and the havoc that this pandemic is wreaking. So that is something that we're up against, and it underscores the need to drive this regime from office. That was something that, frankly, some of us have been working on since just before Trump took office, after the election, but just before Trump took office, through the initiation of Refuse Fascism and putting the call out and working to try to bring it to life to drive the fascist regime from office before it's too late. And while in the midst of a pandemic, we can't go forward with the mass protests in the street, and we have to be creative and working to build up strength and create public opinion for it, but that is still the goal. We have to drive this regime out, and it's not something that's going to be accomplished through the ballot box, because fascists don't go away easily. You know, you've got Donald Trump, who is working to rig the election, was doing it in public, got caught, impeached, but not convicted over it. You you've got a Republican Party that's been working on voter suppression for decades, battles now over, is it actually illegal to allow some people to vote by mail in order to not have to risk their lives to go vote? Then you have the thing of, what if Trump loses but refuses to leave office, contest the election? Who's actually going to make him abide by it? And you have this fascist movement that has been given a lot of air to breathe, a lot of room to operate. The 22,000 people who were at the white supremacist rally on Martin Luther King Day that was supposedly framed around gun rights. But where are those folks going to go? Those people in camouflage stuff and with their military assault weapons and Confederate flags and Nazi banners, where are all those people going to go? They're not going to go away. So this is what we're up against, and we have to look at this and act on it while at the same time recognizing that the problem is the system that spawned all the horrors that Trump and company are now making worse, and that spawned the fascist regime that is now in power.
Carl, I want to get into more on that, but I want to ask you this one question right before you go through all that, okay. Because there's something that's actually really just bugs the hell out of me. And it's this whole thing about, I mean, look, people have to face up to what, and I think it's important what you were saying, that all of this that we've been talking about does in fact add up to a crime against humanity in the making. It's not like it's in the making and waiting to come out. It's actually being imposed on people. It's actually doing, there's an entire sort of, I don't know what you call it. It's a planned assassination of hundreds of thousands of people, of millions of people, really, of what's going on around this. And you think about this, there is this willful abandonment, and that's pretty damn heavy. When you're thinking about everything that happened when we opened this up and we were talking about Ahmaud Arbery, and we're looking at that, like, that in itself, that was a heinous crime that was committed, but it was also a sanctioned crime in a certain sense. And it was, I was really, I think it was because a lot of people, sort of got up there and said, wait a minute, we're not going to just step back so easily and forget about this. But there was a point where those two Nazi yahoos that got out of there, and one who was like a former cop, they get out there and they walked away from this murder. And it was only through, this sort of growing exposure that was going on that they've actually been even, anything was even done to them. And you're looking about this thing about when we're talking about the willful abandonment of millions of black and brown people. And I think it's important for people to understand this is actually in line. It's not an anomaly. It's not something that's sort of like a byproduct, but it's actually in line with the whole genocidal direction that the U.S. has been moving in over the last 40 years. It's not something that just like, last Tuesday it started. This is a leap and a consolidation of a whole genocidal plan and program that has been moving in over 40 years, and it's got a pretty damn solid platform right now. And among a lot of these Nazi creeps that are out there and the people that are sort of just like angry about how I've been mistreated, and they're talking about they're not getting all the privilege that they think that they're entitled to and stuff. This is a horror facing millions of people, and millions of people more should be out there and saying, no, we're not going to allow this to happen. We're not going to allow it to sit there like that, or to come out that, not that it's sitting, but to come out and stand up against this, I mean, this criminal indifference of what's happening to people and the whole thing about the horrors that are unfolded and the criminal indifference that the prison is breeding and pushing out. And too many people are letting that slide by. I think it's really important that people think about that. And we talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. See, I think that's an important and crucial point to bring up, because I talked about having been pushing out this question of mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide for almost a decade now. And when I first began to talk about it, I talked about how this was a slow genocide that could be sped up at any point. And what is happening now is it is being sped up. And it's both a question of the coronavirus and the way in which hundreds of people in prison are dying right now. And they're dying because they're locked up in circumstances where they can do nothing to protect themselves against this. And the authorities are equally doing nothing to protect these people against it. At the same time, you do have the unleashing of this white supremacist base, you know, the kind of people who have long been here, because this is America, a country founded in slavery and genocide, and has remained true to those values and ethics all the way down. But those forces who are working to perpetrate that have been given sustenance and room to operate and air to breathe by the fascists who hold the reins of power in society, the Trump-Pence regime. So they are more out there right now. And I mean, one very interesting thing about Ahmaud Arbery's murder is that the first video that showed his murder was actually released by the murderers. Because when I first saw it, I thought, oh, somebody saw them doing this and unbeknownst to them videoed it. But they were actually aware of the video, and at a certain point, they released it. Obviously not intending for it to have the impact that it had, because they pretty much weren't intending to have a public outcry that forced the authorities to step back and say, oh, I guess this was questionable legally, so I guess we do have to run these guys through the system. Because at first, the cops found out about it, they came, checked it out, and let the guys go. And themselves, the cops actually had the video. They saw it right from the start, saw what was happening, and on that basis, were ready to, you know, send these guys home without even a slap on the wrist or a tsk, don't do it again, saying that this was absolutely legal to hunt this black man down and murder him. People have to look at it and recognize this is what we've come to. There are powerful forces in this society that do sanction all of this, and it is amounting to a speeding up of the locking of black and brown people in this country down into conditions where they can no longer survive and thrive as a people. I'm quoting here from the International Definition of Genocide, by the way. But this is what's going down. And then people have to say, can we stand aside and watch this? Can we sit back and hope that the channels of the system take care of this problem? Or do we need to act to confront it and stop it?
Yeah, that is exactly the biggest question. I mean, and this, what must be done? And I think, you know, it's even for people who were horrified for this, it's not enough to be, it's good to be horrified. It's not enough to be just horrified. And I kept thinking about that in relation to, you know, all of these things that have happened, when we first started talking and you think, you know, I was thinking about all the people who had been thrown to, you know, in one way or another into the jaws of the system, or had actually just, you know, been taken in by the workings of the system. You know, you think about the people that we've talked about many times over, you know, all the Emmett Till, his mother and what she went through, the Panthers, Move Mumia, all of these people all along. And the people today who their biggest damn crime is the fact that they happen to have black or brown skin. I think it's too easy for people to turn their brain away from that. I think it's too easy for them to not recognize what has to be done. But it also, it requires people, both people who know what's going on, and like yourself, you know, and doing what you're doing, of coming out and laying out clearly what's happening and who's responsible. But then also, I know you're also involved in actually working to stop this, not just, you know, and again, it's stop what's happening now, but recognizing that to stop what's happening now, essentially, when you really come down to it, it means we have to stop this system and the way it is steamrolling over people here and all over the world. And this is not, I think it's really important that people recognize that this is not to be tolerated. If you're going to claim humanity, this is not to be tolerated.
No, that is definitely the case. And I think I'm reminded of the three things that Bob Avakian, the leader of the movement for an actual revolution here in this country, and the architect of a pathway to human emancipation, the new communism, he said that there are three things that need to happen. One is that people have to come to understand and confront the actual history of this country. They have to dig into why those things, those horrors that this country has repeatedly inflicted on humanity, where they came from, why they carry them out. And three, they have to engage and grapple with what it's going to take to solve them. And that is the challenge for people right now. Is like you say, you need to recognize the horrors, but it's not enough to recognize the horrors, say that they're horrible, if from there you leave it to somebody make this system work so that it stops those horrors. Because at a certain point, you got to say, this crap happens again and again and again. Then you got to get at, well, why does this system repeat these horrors endlessly? And does that mean that these horrors are not glitches in the system, but actually the way the system is supposed to work? And then you confront the need to get rid of that system. And that is what humanity is faced with, the need for a way to get rid of this system and a force that's acting to realize that in North America. And I'm talking about the program for that, the Constitution for that future socialist republic, which is a blueprint for the kind of society that could be brought into being through this actual revolution. And somebody who has gone to work on how such a revolution could be brought about and put that together in his talk, why we need an actual revolution and how we could really make revolution, how we can really make revolution, which is the title of a talk that he gave on this subject that people who want to see an end to this really need to dig into. They need to check out this talk, engage what Avakian is putting up, and they need to check out and get with the National Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour, which is mainly made up of young people who put their lives on hold to go around the country. And right now they're in Los Angeles working on spreading among people the leadership that we have for this revolution in Bob Avakian, the strategic approach, the blueprint in the Constitution that Avakian has forged, and working to enlist people in the ranks of this actual revolution. This is something that is critically urgent at this moment, that people look at, dig into all of that, and there's some ways to do that, including some new ways to do that. I mean, one way is going to the website revcom.us, where you can find the works of Bob Avakian, the talk that the speech that I talked about, why we need an actual revolution, how we can really make revolution. You can find that there, as well as a number of articles that Avakian has written on topical questions, ranging from the coronavirus and the oppression of women, talking about the elections, talking about a recent article on emancipation from mental slavery and oppression. All of that's there, as well as catching the criminals, the global criminals, the imperialist and principally U.S. imperialism in the commission of their crimes, but also talking about how all of this could be ended through revolution. People need to go to that website. They also need to check out on YouTube the weekly RNL show, which is Revolution Nothing Less. Because this weekly YouTube show comes on every Thursday, and it's another way that the Movement for an Actual Revolution is reaching out, trying to connect with people. And people need to check it out. There was a special on the lynching of Ahmaud Arbery, the oppression of black people, and the solution to it in terms of the revolution we need. That was the most recent episode of it. There's a new episode coming out on Thursday. And these are all archived on the RevCom YouTube channel so that people can, if you miss its premiere on Thursday night, you can watch them, you know, further down the road, and you can subscribe to it so you get notification every time it comes out.
All right, Carl, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
I want to thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Carl Dix, a longtime revolutionary and a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, in the course of our conversation, Carl mentioned two works by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which you can find on revcom.us. They are The Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, and the video of the talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. That's revcom.us.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. And I mean every word of it. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn.
That was Nina Simone with Mississippi, goddamn.
If I were a preacher.
Now we're going to hear Bob Avakian, BA, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. How long? How many more times do the tears have to flow? Taken from the talk, B.A. speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less.
Looking out at what goes on, with the nightmare of oppression and brutality that so many in this world are forced to endure, day after day, generation after generation, I would cry out, how long, O Lord? Now, in case there's any confusion, I am not a preacher, and I'll have more to say about the Lord as we go along. But let's look at what this system does to people. Let's start with just one great crime of this system. Police murder after murder after murder of black people and Latinos, especially youth. Check it out. If you go on the internet and you search for police kill unarmed youth, you will scroll down and down and down and down for pages and pages and pages with the same pattern, the same ugly pattern repeating itself. And you will see that not only are these youth unarmed, but once again, overwhelmingly, they are black and Latino. And if you search a little deeper and a little further, you will see that almost never are the police punished or even prosecuted for these grotesque and wanton murders. And you will run into two of the most wounding words in the English language at this point: justifiable homicide, which the family and loved ones of those so wantonly killed are repeatedly slapped in the face with as the verdict on these murders. Let's just take a couple of the latest outrages. Manuel Diaz, murdered by the police in Anaheim, shot in the back and then shot in the back of the head. While the next day in the same city of Anaheim, another Latino youth, Joel Acevedo, was also shot down by the police. And here's an irony that came out in relation to the murder of Manuel Diaz. His mother said at one point Manuel was thinking about joining the army. Think about this. You can be a black or Latino youth out on the streets with no prospects and no future. Only the possibility of getting yourself into trouble, running up against other youth just like you and maybe getting into it with them, or running up against the police. Or you can join the army of the same system that's put you on the street in that situation to reinforce with brute force the same system that has put you in that situation, and to go out into the world and be part of the mindless killing machine doing the same thing to people just like you all around the world? Or what about Oscar Grant, killed a couple of years ago in Northern California by the BART, the Rapid Transit Police? This was also caught on the cell phones of many people. They knocked him to the ground, straddled him while he was face down, and shot him to death. Captured on the cell phones, but it made no difference. Through the lengthy process they always go through, in this case because the people rose up, they had to prosecute. But once again, we run into the situation where, strangely, in these kind of situations, the prosecutors who vigorously prosecute with full animus when they're going after someone like Oscar Grant forget how to prosecute when it's the cops on trial. And the whole thing is set up so the cop gets off on a light charge, a minor sentence, and is back out. Think of the outrage of this and the insult on top of the outrage to the family and loved ones and to everyone who cares about justice. Or what about Romarley Graham in New York City? Killed in his own house by the police. He's walking home in his neighborhood. He's a black youth, so the police assume he must be up to no good. He must be selling drugs. He looks furtive. He's making strange motions. What he's doing is taking out his keys and opening the door to his house. He walks into his own house. He's killed in his own house by the police in front of family and loved ones. And in response to this, his mother comes forward and says, "This has got to stop." And his father, almost as if in a trance, keeps repeating over and over again, "Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son?" And they weren't done yet. The New York cops then came to the courtroom and applauded their fellow pig who murdered Romarley in cold blood, viciously taunting the family and loved ones of Romarley and demonstrating yet one more time the ugly truth that in the way this country has been built and for the powers that be in this country, the humanity of black people has never counted for anything. They have never been valued as human beings, but only as things to be exploited, oppressed, and repressed. How many more times does this have to happen? How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? And if this is not enough, this system viciously exploits people twice, abusing and brutalizing them, and then taking the tortured beauty of their cries of agony and outrage and capitalizing on it, declaring it to be a great expression of the marvelous American culture and its diversity. Think about the blues, for example. There's a lot of stuff in blues that's about personal problems and some nonsense, including men wanting to dominate women. But to a large degree, the blues is about the experience and the suffering of black people in America. Notice it's called the blues, not la, 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 we're living the American dream. Or how about jazz? I'm thinking of when I moved to Chicago in the 1970s. I didn't have a car, and I had to take a cab. And I got in a cab that was driven by this hip young white guy. I don't mean these kind of phony hipsters they got around now. I mean a real hip young white guy. As we started talking, it turned out that he was a jazz musician, or a musician in general, and was just driving a cab to try to be able to keep going. He reminded me of a scene I saw in a Richard Pryor concert, where he got up and before he came on the stage, Patti LaBelle and her band had performed. And Richard Pryor said, "Did you see that white guy playing the saxophone up there? He was just like this. With every note, he didn't miss a note. Just like, go ahead, brothers, I'm with you. I ain't missing it. Go ahead, I'm with you." And that's what this cab driver reminded me of. And after we talked a while, he said to me, "Are you into jazz?" And I said, "Well, not really that much. I've listened to some jazz, I like it, but I'm more sort of into rhythm and blues." He said, "You really got to get into jazz. If you listen seriously to jazz, if you listen to Coltrane, what you hear is all the long years of oppression and suffering of black people coming right out the end of his instrument." So I thought, well, I guess I'm going to have to get into jazz some more. But there was a deep truth there. Yes, there's love, as Coltrane put it, a love supreme. But there was also defiance and anger. Now, how many times does this have to keep going on? Now, once again, I'm not a preacher. And if people crying out, "How long, O Lord, could put things right," there should be no more need for people to keep on crying out in this way, and no more need for them to keep on praying. The Lord should have put things right a long time ago. And if the Lord really existed, we would have to ask, what is the matter with the boy that he let things go so wrong for so long in the first place? Now, the truth is, there is no Lord. And we do not need, nor should we want or accept, any lords and masters, imaginary ones or real ones, lording it over us. Some say this is all God's will. No, it is not. And it does great injury to those suffering so terribly and so unnecessarily in this world to tell them that this is God's will, or attest that this supposed God has set before them to endure horrible oppression in this world with the promise of a better life in some other world, some afterlife, which is not real and will never come. But ask yourself this: if there were a God or gods, why would it be the will of that God or gods that for so long, so many people have suffered so terribly with oppression, degradation, and brutality, while a much smaller number continue to accumulate wealth and exercise power and live lives of parasitic indulgence on the basis of exploiting and oppressing those masses of people all over the world? Why would that be the will of this God? And then let's go on and ask the next question that suggests itself. Whose interest does it serve for people to believe that all this is God's will? Now, I know there are people who feel inspired and sustained by their religious beliefs in the fight against injustice, including the unjust wars repeatedly waged by the American government. Some have spent their lives dedicated to acting on what they identify as prophetic traditions within religion, which they see as calling for standing with and standing up for the poor and oppressed, and fighting against injustice. We respect and work to build unity with people holding and acting on those sentiments. In accordance with the communist principles and objectives on which our party is based, we recognize the great importance of reaching out and building unity broadly with people of many diverse viewpoints in the fight against the crimes of this system and the great suffering this causes. And these same principles and objectives also lead us to recognize the importance of boldly and forthrightly putting forward our communist viewpoint and of engaging in serious and principled discussion, and yes, struggle, with people coming from different worldviews, in the spirit of seeking the truth and striving to bring forward and to act in the fullest way in accordance with the fundamental interests of the masses of people. It is in this spirit that I am putting forward the views of our party, straight up and full out. Communists are atheists. We do not believe in any gods or any kind of supernatural forces or beings. There is no evidence for the existence of a god or gods, or of any supernatural forces or beings, no evidence which is based in the real world and can be tested in this real world, which is the only existence there is. There is, however, plenty of evidence for the fact that human beings have invented gods and supernatural forces. Now let me say this. I am sick to death of the daily and continual horrors that life under this system means for the great majority of humanity. And I am sick to death of having to say how long, even if not, O Lord. And while I am a firm scientific atheist and do not believe in any gods, I can say, and I do say, God damn these motherfuckers.
You can find the entire talk and numerous clips and much more from BA at revcom.us. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today and each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Now we're going to play I Can't Breathe by the family of Eric Garner.
The wind blows.